Global warming is coming, baby. It's gonna get you.
What will it cost to save the remnants of a livable climate from our greenhouse gases? Lord Adair Turner explains the Stern Report, given to the UK government in 2006, saying the cost of fixing the problem is far less than the damage caused by a hotter and unstable climate. This is Alex Smith reporting. In a speech given at Savoy Place in London, February 7, 2007, Turner also answers economic and social critics of the Stern Report. I'm going to give you a quick guide to the speech with a few quotes. You can download the whole thing from the climate section at www.ecoshock.org. It's 1 hour long.
We are conducting an enormous chemical experiment which is almost certain to raise the Earth's temperature significantly, and that temperature increase is already occurring. So the key question is no longer, is global warming occurring, but what are we going to do about it? And since the causes of the warming are economic, the progress of material prosperity, so must the solutions be built on sound economics.
Here is a quick, clear summary of the Stern Report conclusions.
Now, Stern's overall conclusion is that if we do not act, the overall costs and risks of climate change will be equivalent to losing at least 5% of global GDP each year, now and forever. If a wider range of risks and impacts is taken into account, the estimate of damage could rise to 20% or more. While in contrast, the costs of action, reducing greenhouse gas emissions to avoid the worst impact of climate change, can be limited to around 1% of global GDP each year.
The net is buzzing with critics of the approach Sir Nicholas Stern takes when adding up the costs of climate change. Here are the two major arguments.
First, the criticisms of the Stern report. Second, the case presented in what was called the Copenhagen Consensus Project, which was organized by Bjorn Lomborg. Together, those arguments make the following case. They say that even if the majority view of climate change scientists, as expressed in the IPCC assessments, is correct, sound economics suggests that we should take action later rather than sooner, and sound ethics suggests spending our money on more pressing problems such as AIDS, malaria, or malnutrition. And it's these assertions I'll assess tonight.
Some economists have been negative about Stern's methods.
It's this summary assessment which has unleashed controversy in the economics profession. Professor William Nordhaus has accused Stern of failing to present a balanced picture. Professor Partha Dasgupta believes that, I quote, parameter values have been chosen to yield desired results, which in economic parlance is a really brutal thing to say about someone. While Professor Richard Toll, though he is quoted approvingly by Stern at several points in his review, has actually gone completely ballistic. If a student of mine had handed in this report as a master's thesis, Toll says, if I were in a good mood, I would give him a D for diligence, but more likely I would give him an F for fail. Though I have to say that when you look at all Toll's comments, they are so dramatically internally inconsistent between one paragraph and the next that it is difficult to take that attack seriously. But certainly the debate has been joined. Seminars are being held, commentaries are being written and posted on the internet. There is an entire blog universe to do with the discount rate.
This is not the place to dive into complex arguments by economists. Adair Turner deals with the major schools of thought in the second half of his speech, and it can get technical. It helps to know what the term discount rate means in advance. You may want to look that up. Still, the discussion is important because big business and big governments do understand this money logic and use it to make decisions that may determine the fate of the Earth. At this point, we can't stop climate change, but we can reduce the impacts for future generations. Let's look at the costs of mitigation.
But the complexity and subjectivity relate almost entirely to the costs of adverse consequences and adaptation, much less to the costs of mitigation. Because the striking agreed fact in all this debate, in the complex economics of climate change, is that the costs of mitigation are surprisingly small. The Stern Review investigates the possible costs of a policy designed to limit concentrations of all greenhouse gases to a maximum of about 550 parts per million, which is equivalent to a CO2 element of somewhere about 480 to 490 parts per million. That would probably still imply a temperature increase of, say, 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, so about 2.3 against the present level, which would be up against what we might think the tipping point might be, but it would greatly reduce the risk of significantly higher increases. It would require that emissions were set on something like this trajectory, peaking around 2020 to 25, down 25% against today's global level by 2050, and eventually down 80% below present levels, and even more, something like 90% against business as usual. Given the inevitable growth of per capita emissions in China and India towards developed country levels, this would require rich countries like the UK to cut emissions by something like 60% from current levels by 2050. But the Stern Review's best estimate of the global cost of this path is about 1% of global GDP. And previous estimates for the UK suggest that the cost of cutting our emissions by 60% by 2050 would be something like 0.3 to 2% of GDP in that year, let's say 1% as a mid-estimate, which would mean that rather than UK GDP growing at, say, 2% per annum from now to 2050, it might grow at 1.98% per annum, opening up the huge gap in prosperity that you can see on this slide between the firm line and the dotted line, though it's possible that those of you at the back of the hall can't see that there are two lines there at all. GDP in 2050 would be just 1% or so below what it would otherwise be, and prosperity would reach in about July 2050 the level it would otherwise have reached in January, a level about 2 to 2.5 times the current. And the estimates for the US are of similar magnitude, which doesn't exactly sound to me like a threat to the American way of life. And what's interesting is that while in the economic profession there's a lively debate about whether we should accept even those small costs, there is close to unanimity that the costs of achieving emission cuts are small. This is a bit of the debate where the pessimists say that it might be 3 or 4% rather than 1%. But nobody says that it will be 10 or 15 or 20%.
Now Adair Turner offers us three ways to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
Think about three ways of cutting carbon emissions: changes in lifestyle, improvements in energy efficiency, and deriving our energy from non-carbon emitting sources. The first category, minor changes in lifestyle, involves no cost to GDP at all. If people can be persuaded to buy more fuel-efficient cars, what happens is that they spend less money on cars and have more to spend on other less carbon-emitting forms of consumption, while GDP and GDP growth don't change one iota. And if they are persuaded to do that by increased taxation on petrol, offset by lower taxes on other consumption items, GDP growth doesn't change one iota. If American air conditioning was set 1 or 2 degrees higher, and people spent the money saved on other categories of consumption, American GDP growth doesn't fall by even the smallest fraction of a percent. And there would, of course, be a lot of happier foreign visitors, no longer bewildered by the idea that you should spend money to send such a blast of cold air down on you that we need to dress more warmly in an office in Atlanta in the summer than we would dream of dressing in our office in London in the winter. In rich developed societies, we face multiple opportunities to adapt our behaviour in ways which cut emissions significantly, but which make only very minor differences to our overall lifestyle. We are also faced with numerous opportunities in households and in companies to use more energy efficient technologies in ways which cost us nothing and which don't even require any changes in end lifestyle. Setting the air conditioning a few degrees warmer requires a very minor adjustment in the end lifestyle, in what is the end consumption, a slightly warmer environment. But, and at this stage, I'm afraid I've forgotten my props, which are sitting outside. But I'm an economist, and therefore I can say, imagine two light bulbs. And what I'm going to say is that using this light bulb, rather than this light bulb, changes lifestyle not at all. Because they both produce the same amount of light, but this one, which you can clearly see in my hand, is a 12-watt bulb, and this one a 60-watt bulb, an 80% cut in emissions for the same end benefit. And if you buy this light bulb, over a 5-year period, the light bulbs and the electricity used cost you 10% less than if you used the 60-watt light bulb, and so that your material prosperity, measured in your ability to spend more money on other items of consumption, actually goes up. Households face many such opportunities, and throughout the economy, companies too are sitting on huge opportunities to save energy through the redesign of processes in ways which simultaneously cut emissions and give positive returns, if only they make energy saving a key focus of management attention. In the UK, work by the Carbon Trust suggests that Britain could cut carbon emissions by at least 10% in ways which, far from costing money, actually save money and are positive NPV projects, and which therefore, far from cutting the growth rate, would actually increase it. So by minor changes in lifestyle and through energy efficiency improvement, we can go a long way to cut emissions at minimal or indeed nil economic cost, and to cut emissions even if our energy comes from the same mix of sources as today. But the third category of change is to change the energy source, either to renewable sources, wind power, solar, biofuels, or to fossil fuels used in a non-carbon emitting fashion, capturing the CO2 at the power station outlet and storing it by injecting it into geological structures, carbon capture and storage. And it's this third route which is most likely to result in some cut to GDP and to the growth of GDP, because low-carbon energy sources are likely to be more expensive than carbon-emitting sources, but not that much more expensive, and in some cases, no more expensive at all.
Here is an easy explanation of how Sir Nicholas Stern arrived at his figure, that reducing greenhouse gases would only cost about 1.5% of our gross wealth.
So that the reason why economists are close to unanimous that the total cost of radical emission cuts will be at most only a few percentage points of GDP is the following simple but absolutely robust mathematical logic. A developed, rich economy, such as Britain or America, spends about 4 to 5% of its GDP on energy inputs. By 2050, that percentage will probably be only about 2 to 3%, simply because even under business as usual, we steadily improve the energy efficiency of our economy. So suppose that in order to reduce CO2 emissions by 60%, we have to pay 50% more per unit for all our energy than we do today. Then the economic cost of doing that is 50% of 2 to 3%, which is 1 to 1.5%.
The cost of such things as extinctions or displacement of hundreds of millions of people are very hard to measure in dollars or pounds.
And climate change might produce what economists call socially contingent effects, creeping desertification producing movement of people, which in turn produces political instability, which in turn undermines economic progress and quality of life. But try putting a figure on that danger. And climate change can impose costs which are entirely subjective, but which are also part of the calculus of human welfare. Personally, I value the diversity of nature as an end in itself. If climate change leads to habitat loss, which leads to the disappearance of major species, I would regret that. And the fact that people give large amounts of money to environmental charities suggests that many other people share that preference. It is what economists call a revealed preference. So the preservation of the environment and of species as an end in itself should be given some value in the calculation. But how much? So there is a major problem in aggregating direct economic effects, which influence measured GDP and material consumption, with non-market effects on health, on social stability, or on the environment itself.
In this clip, Turner offers us four conclusions from the economic models.
But insofar as the aggregate figures tell us anything, we should take from them four messages. First, that there is a huge range of uncertainty, but that uncertainty is an argument in favour of action, in favour of taking out an insurance policy not an action against. Second, that almost all the models indicate much higher costs to human welfare in poorer developing countries than in rich developed ones, simply because the poorer countries are concentrated in already warmer parts of the world and are vulnerable precisely because they are poor. Third, that the models suggest that adverse consequences will probably increase rapidly as we go beyond thresholds of something like 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels, which is something like 2 degrees centigrade above present levels. Fourth, that inevitably judgmental but still reasonable assumptions can produce estimates of total damage far higher than our much more certain estimates of the cost of mitigation. These four conclusions establish a strong case for action, and in particular for action which seeks to limit the chances that future temperature rises will go above some modest threshold.
I'm not going to explore the arguments between Stern's methods and the criticisms of economists like Nordhaus or Dasgupta. Essentially, they are not arguing about the cost of fixing the problem, but the difficulty of estimating the cost of doing little or nothing at present, but just letting the greenhouse gases build up and then acting later. Next, Adair answers social critics who worry that government and personal spending on fixing climate change for the future will take away vital money needed to solve current problems, like the AIDS epidemic or world poverty. Here is Adair Turner.
But one final argument against early action on climate change has been advanced by Bjorn Lomborg, that emission reductions, whether or not desirable in the long term, are a lower priority than action on other global problems. Lomborg organized the Copenhagen Consensus Project, which asked a panel of respected economists to rank possible policy initiatives on the basis of their benefit to mankind. Three proposed climate change projects were ranked bottom of the list, which instead favoured projects to combat AIDS, malaria, and malnutrition. And Lomborg has paraded the ranking as proof that early action on climate change is uneconomic. But this interpretation of the consensus findings is deeply misleading, given the specific question which was posed, which was, where should the world invest, say, $50 billion over the next 4 years to do most good? Because it's quite possible, in answer to that question, to argue that AIDS and malaria projects should have priority, while also strongly supporting early action to cut carbon emissions. Now, that would obviously be true if we just simply say, well, the world should do all beneficial projects. We could say, well, if climate change mitigation benefits are higher than costs, let's do it, even if the short-term payback to AIDS projects is greater still. We should do both. But it is sometimes useful to accept the discipline of a constrained budget as an intellectual discipline. But even if you do that, the idea of a choice between AIDS projects and climate change responsibility is largely meaningless, because many actions to reduce emissions do not compete for limited resources, but often release them. That is clearly true of many Category 2 actions, energy efficiency improvements. If a company, encouraged by a high tax on carbon-intensive electricity but compensated by a lower payroll tax, identifies energy-efficient projects with a positive net present value, it will be no less able to make charitable donations or corporation tax payments to support the policies which the Copenhagen consensus favours. There is no trade-off there. But this is still more obviously the case in respect to Category 1 actions, changes in consumer behaviour. If individuals feel motivated by climate change responsibility or encouraged by a changed taxation regime to buy a more fuel-efficient car or to go by tube or bike to work, they will have more, not less, resources available for charitable donations to AIDS funds or to pay taxes to support overseas development expenditure.
Finally, beyond economics, there may be some psychic benefits when we feel we are fighting off the worst of climate change, and this may lead to changes in consumer choices.
In an already materially rich society, many of our consumption patterns are not inherently essential to our welfare or happiness, but reflect deliberately stimulated desires and arbitrary habits, both of which can change without any loss of welfare, utility, or happiness, or whatever you mean. It may be the case that stimulated by a car advertisement, probably shot at about 4 a.m. in northern Sweden, the SUV owner gains psychic benefits from navigating at a snail's pace down the King's Road because in his imagination he could have been splashing through a mountain stream. But it is equally possible that stimulated by a desire for climate change responsibility, equivalent psychic benefits can be gained from driving a Prius or a G-Wiz, while driving an SUV can suddenly create happiness-degrading sense of guilt.
We have been exploring a speech by businessman and government advisor Lord Adair Turner of Britain as he defends the Stern Report on climate change. The full speech by Adair Turner, given February 7, 2007, is available on the net as a video and as an audio file in the climate section of www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org. I'm Alex Smith, and thanks for caring about the climate.
The more we care about the welfare of future generations, the more we should take climate change actions today. There is nothing in sound economics which frees us from that ethical choice.